You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, listener. Welcome to Switch It. So that was Basball versus Spindia, round two. England galloped off with the plaudits after the first test, but were made to chase the game in Vishakhapatnam, and a fourth innings target of 399 ultimately proved too much, even for Ben Stokes' brave boys, despite running towards the danger in the manner we've come to expect. Never mind spin, it turns out in Indian conditions there are few things more dangerous than the catapult arm of Jasprit Bumrah, who helped wrap things up with a 9-wicket haul. Following on from Yashasvi Jaiswal's tone-setting double hundred, it was undoubtedly a case of Jazz trumping Baz in Vizag. Just a puff of dust, or the first signs of England's tour going up in smoke. Joining me on the pod to discuss such matters are ESPN Cricket Info UK editor Andrew Miller and associate editor Vitushan Ehantharajah. Good to see you, gents. I'll come to you first, Miller. 5-0 is off the table. The 106-run margin was pretty comfortable in the end. But do you think, like James Anderson does, that India have been spooked by England's no-fear approach?
I think they have, genuinely. I mean, if you going back to what you said there at the start about the running towards the danger, I mean, there was nothing in world cricket quite as dangerous as Jasprit Bumrah on a roll. And any other team facing a bowler bowling that well would have been rolled over the moment it started. You know, right, we cannot compete with this, we're done. England kept going, they kept believing they could win, so much so that by the time Shubman Gill was interviewed after his century, he was conceding that even chasing 399, England had a 30% chance of doing it. I mean, that's not normal maths when it comes to chasing 399, given the record in India is 276, I think, by West Indies, a great West Indies team in the 1980s. By visiting team, exactly. And no one's chased more than 418 in any test anywhere. And yet, India believed that England had a fighting chance of chasing 399. So, yeah, they're in their heads, absolutely. I mean, it's... I suppose the thing that we've come to accept about this England team is that every given day, someone is going to get out of bed and do something remarkable because they are just given the license to do so. They're allowed to believe that today could be my day. There's no reason it shouldn't be my day. There, no one in this test for England, apart from arguably James Anderson, who bowled brilliantly, but no one in this test produced the day that Ollie Pope had, say, whereas Jasprit Bumrah came out and produced the day that he had. And that ultimately was the difference between the two teams. If an Indian player doesn't play as well as Jasprit Bumrah in the next test, I believe England will be favourites again because of that edge they have by simply believing that nothing is ever lost for them.
And winning the toss probably helped as well. Vish, we'll get to the game in due course, but firstly, can you tell us what you're planning to do for the next week since you neither play golf nor have a ticket to Abu Dhabi?
Yeah, so I am going to experience, you know, real authentic India. I'm going to go to Goa for a few days.
you're visiting our esteemed colleague, Sid Monger.
I am actually, yeah. I'm actually staying near the beach where he walks his dogs. So he either lives in a lovely, lovely part of the world, or he's sold me a fast one, and I'm basically going to be hanging out with loads of dogs, loads of smelly kind of sand encrusted dogs for the next few days. So I'm excited to find out.
Are you going to be his dog sitter for a week?
Maybe that's it. I feel like I've been done here. It's England and India in 2021 all over again. You know, they get a bit comfortable and, yeah, suddenly it's all change.
You're sharing a bubble. And it looks like, at least from a quick check on Instagram, that the view out your window is pretty decent where you are currently.
Yeah, although I can't look out of there too much because they're always England players kind of near the pool and I look like one of those journos who's constantly eyeballing them, so... Every now and again, I do have to pull the curtains, but it's just that Ben Stokes doesn't think I'm spying on him.
Oh, yes. No, we We wouldn't want that. Let's move on from the thought of you watching England's players by the swimming pool from your darkened bedroom. Get back to Baz and Ben's excellent adventure. A quick recap. Depleted by injury and absence, India nevertheless found the key individual performances required to win the second test, notably from Bumrah, Jaiswal and Shubman Gill. They held off another England comeback to square the series, 1-1 with 3 to play. McCullum supposedly told the players on the second evening they could go out and chase 600 if needed. Miller, England do have the knack for fourth innings heroics, but this time they left themselves a bit too much to do.
Yeah, they did. I mean, you know, I think it's interesting, isn't it? There's no consequences in England's team, but I suspect there are quiet learnings to be had. And I'm sure within that dressing room or in Abu Dhabi or wherever they're going to hunker down and debrief, insofar as they do debrief anything, they can analyse a few moments that perhaps went awry for them. You know, largely, I think, to be honest, in that chase, they were unlucky. I think the LBWs, particularly that the contentious one to Zach Crawley, and then LBW, the Johnny Bairstow one on the stroke of lunch, that would have been, you know, if I think it was less out than Shubman Gill's was, that wasn't given. You know, those fine margins, not to say there's anything wrong with umpire's call. I think it's a very good system. But England were on the wrong side of that. I think that was a factor. And then Ben Stokes' run out was, as he put it, running through treacle and just had a brain fade or whatever it was. I mean, that was a moment that, again, if half an hour of Ben Stokes doing what he can do and suddenly 106 margin is not 106 margin, and then you're really into squeaky bum territory. So, you know, it seems daft to sort of analyse it as a near miss, but it clearly was. It was another example of England just tearing up the conventions of Test cricket by believing that nothing is impossible. And because, again, they have this no consequences, the lack of fear just gives them an edge. I mean, if you look at particularly Shubman Gill's innings, the terror that existed in the first half hour of that innings when he survived two LBW appeals, one of them an inside edge he didn't even notice, then an edge through the slips that Root was too wide to catch. You can sense the weight of consequence, the weight of abuse that is waiting to rain on India if they do lose the series at home to England, is completely different to the complete lack of care that England have about going out and playing wildly. I mean, Joe Root played a honking innings, I'm sure we'll get into it, of 16 from 10, but there's going to be no consequences about that. You know, we can tee off all we like in the media about how Joe Root should play more responsibly. You won't hear a word of that in the dressing room. You may hear Joe Root himself might analyse the way he played and think, OK, I need to chill out here, but you're not going to get Stokes or McCullum tearing off a strip for irresponsibility. And therefore, again, every time they go out, it's a blank slate. It is an extraordinary con that they are performing every time they play. And as a consequence, they're getting a lot closer in situations where they shouldn't come even remotely close.
This was the third defeat in 11 run chases under Stokes and McCullum. I mean, Vish, you wrote about how they had, how they have torn up these conventions and so on. It felt like too many, didn't it, this chase, even though, as Miller says, they maybe didn't quite get the rub of the green. But even at a sort of 100 for one and Rehan Ahmed night-hawking it around, there was an awful long way to go. And I mean, as in the first innings, no one really, really got stuck in and played that big innings. And we'll perhaps get into some of that in a bit. But even if Zach Crawley hadn't got a bit of a shooter on leg stump, and whether Hawkeye was right on that, that's one for the technical boffins. Chasing 400 just doesn't happen very often. Certainly not 30% of the time, as Gill suggested.
Yeah, it just felt that there was enough opportunity for mistakes, as it were, given the way England play, as Miller alludes to there. Going into finally with 3:30 odd left, having, you know, because they'd knocked over 67 the night before for just the loss of Ben Duckett, there was a sense that they could do something quite cool, and even get close. I know, you know, we talk about moral victories and stuff like that, but getting close to that figure, becoming the first visiting team to get over 300 in a fourth innings in India would have been quite cool, would have been something that they'd have celebrated to a point. I don't know, they weren't that hard on themselves at the end of the day. You know, they were back out playing football a couple of hours after close. But I did leave there thinking that they've missed an opportunity. And part of that is because this is the weakest India 11 that they'll face, given the, you know, the players that are out of this test and the players that are, and some of those players which are, who are likely to come back in Rajkot. But, you know, you think, yeah, Joe Root's dismissal. I totally agree with Miller about the contentiousness of that LBW that Crawley got. But even Pope, he was a sense that, like, you know, he was frenetic and got away with it at the start of his second innings in Hyderabad and kind of felt like lightning wasn't going to strike twice. Certainly not to that degree. And it felt like by lunch, basically, with five down, it was basically done. And, yeah, I think the... You know, you mentioned losing the toss as well. It felt like they didn't do all that much wrong across the course of the test, other than the fact that India were better in that on that second day. But then you could look at that first inning, and think, yeah, you could have pulled a lot more out of that. And there is a sense that this break is coming at the right time for both teams, really, because it gives India a bit of time to assess, among many other things, what the situation is with Virat Kohli. But also with England, you just got a sense that they were getting a bit tired of things. You know, I know people will laugh because they've only really been in the country for 2 weeks, going on three. But, you know, being in the same hotel as them is quite an eye-opener in terms of, you know, being hidden away and stuff like that, and just being constantly asked for selfies and this, that and the other, often by people who are there to keep other people away from them. So... and the other thing that's emerged over the last couple of days is this virus that seems to be doing the rounds. I think someone who I won't name saw someone else who I won't name dry heaving in the foyer about 3 hours ago. And, you know, that kind of sums it up. We're already at that stage. So, I mean, it's going to be a pretty horrendous flight back if people have to contend with that. And, you know, I've already heard of a couple of people who, again, will remain nameless, who are thinking, right, see my family tomorrow. I'm going to lock myself away in the room while this virus does its business. So, A, thank you for infecting the hotel. But B, I think it just feels like getting away and just not quite recalibrating, because they're not going to play any cricket or do any training, but almost just kind of parking it and thinking, right, it's 1-1 in that two test series. We've got three test series coming up and we go again.
Yeah, this is England setting out the blueprint for future tours, isn't it? You play a couple of tests and then go on holiday in the middle of it and then play another couple of
tests.
It's
amazing. I was actually thinking, actually, you know, there is all these, you know, bumper 1-year, 2-year, 3-year contracts. Do they have like an annual leave allowance now? Do they have to, you know, in the way that we have to fill in the days, or sometimes we forget and we have to do it, you know, after the actual break themselves? But I wonder if Rob Key's just sitting at home, just clicking through all these, just approving all this annual leave. But
yeah, they're definitely not building up many loo days with all these 3 and 4 day finishes. But yeah, you know, you keep an eye out those curtains, because someone might be sick in the pool, and you know, then we'll have a story. Just on the Crawley thing, because to me, that second innings LBW looked pretty stock standard. What did England think was wrong with it? That it didn't pitch in line? That it wasn't ball tracking got it wrong somehow? I thought, having, you know, seen the replay, that, you know, that all looks in order.
To be honest, I kind of got it, but I think the contention isn't that it was hitting and it wasn't hitting. I think the contention is the scale of the hitting, as it were. There's got to be a better way to say that. Yeah. But I think they expected it.
They thought it'd be umpire's call. Right, okay.
Exactly. I mean, which would have stayed with Murray's Erasmus's decision.
Presumably.
And the fact that it wasn't.
There's always a cusp there where it's going to go one way or the other. But yeah, sorry, Miller.
No, but that's fundamentally the point of umpire's call. It mitigates the the expectation levels of whoever's about to be disappointed. If it is umpire's call and it looks like it's marginal and it shows as umpire's call, it's, oh, fine, that's one that's gone away. If it's umpire's call, if it looks as marginal as that LBW was and it's given not out, then suddenly you're turning completely on its head, 180-degree flip. That feels wrong to me. That's the sort of VAR levels of wrong in the degree of expectation management. That is what I think annoys people the most about this decision. It's not a bit like the two LBWs I mentioned earlier, the Anderson one to Gill and one to Bairstow. It's like the Gill one was probably on, I think, looked more out than Bairstow's. That's my personal subjective opinion. But because the on-field decision was out and not out respectively, it mitigated the disappointment when you see the replay and think, oh, fine, that was a near miss. I think that that's a thing that's really annoying, I think, for the expectations of that, particularly on the just going into lunch. It's a big appeal. It's given on out. You think, okay, well, that was close, but he's got away with it. And then something, oh, my God, he's been stiffed. That, I think, is the frustration. And again, I reference VAR because we get this sort of thing every day in the Premier League because that system is so appalling. Whereas actually, I think umpire's call, broadly speaking, is very good. But this was about as marginal as you get. You know, there's a 49.9% out. Suddenly looks like 100% out. That's going to feel very much a big change compared to the smaller margins you see elsewhere. If that makes any sort of sense.
A 52-48 call.
Exactly. Though you know those things generally do wind people up, don't they?
I wanted to talk about another Crawley dismissal. In the first innings, and you know, I think we've kind of established that second afternoon is where India won the game, and Jasprit Bumrah's spell is at the heart of that. But it was Crawley's dismissal. England were 114 for one, and you know, seemingly bazballing their way towards 400 plus, having done, I think by common consensus, a pretty good job of keeping India below 400, despite Jaswal scoring 209, the next high score being Shubman Gill's 34. But Crawley attacks Axar Patel, who's just come into the attack, hits, I think, the second ball of the over for four, third ball of the over, he skies it to backward point. And while accepting completely that this is Baswell and that's the way they play, I was trying to imagine what Bob Willis on The Verdict would have said. And Vish, there will be no recriminations. But, I mean, from that point, the game ran away from England. They were 114 for one, and then it was suddenly 182 for seven, and any chance of getting near India's first innings total was gone.
Yeah, it probably did run away from England. And I think what was encouraging was Zach Crawley, you know, much like the shot, caught himself in a bit of a bind when he did press at the end of the day, because he said exactly that, you know, he has to keep attacking, he has to keep playing that way, he should keep playing that way, because if not, he regresses back to the kind of pre-2023 Crawley, which, you know, certainly he doesn't want to be anymore.
No one wants to see that.
Understandably so. Yeah, but within that, he did also say that when he was in the dressing room, looking at the wickets falling after him, he thought, damn, basically that's on me. And I think I think that's a really interesting part of that, because I'm not necessarily sure he vocalized it, because if he did, he would have been talked out of that. You know, someone would have said to him, oh, mate, leave it. Yeah. Don't worry about it. It's not your fault. You know,
that's more Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, shaking him like Matt Damon and Robbie Williams in Good Will Hunting. But I think there's something that has actually happened over the last 2 weeks. I'm sensing to a point is some of the younger players are actually stepping up and taking responsibility in quite quiet ways. Ben Duckett has been responsible for, you know, some strong opening stands this series already, and yet hasn't quite cracked on. And there is, you know, you get a sense from him that he's, you know, when he gets out, he's obviously annoyed he gets out, but there seems a bit more of, right, I want to score here as well, actually. You know, one of the other things that came out in that Crawley press conference was, Someone asked him, you know, McCullum said said you'll never be a consistent player, so you must be really worried about what's happened over the last 9 months. And he said, you know, he said, well, I think we all know he said that because I wasn't playing very well at all, but you know, that's who doesn't want to be a consistent player type thing. And I think,
consistent,
you know,
we saw match winner.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the next stage, isn't it? We saw it during the Ashes that there was a bit of a recalibration, or a massive recalibration after Lords. And I think there'll be a bit of a recalibration after this with individuals. I know we're probably going to talk about Joe Root in a bit more detail, but certainly for Pope, who's already got a big score, Crawley, who's already had an impressive start to his series, I think there's a sense of, actually, we want the next level now as well.
Yeah, and that's what England were missing. There were four scores above 50 in the game, one in each innings. Crawley was the man both times for England, 76 and 73, but obviously that was trumped by a double hundred and a century for Gill. Miller, the next passage of play was something England couldn't do much about. Jasper Bumrah, reverse swinging ball. I think it was two spells, sort of split by one over, one stray over, but basically either side of the break, 3 for 12 off 8 overs from Bumrah, and there was no doubt about the pièce de résistance in there. Ollie Pope looking quite set and settled, having two of his stumps detonated from the ground in the old style.
I mean, it was absolutely god level bowling. I mean, you know, we get spoiled, I think, in this day and age, because you know, it's. There's a lot of fun cricket going on when you look around, but every now and again you look at something like that and think, okay, that is different gravy. That is something above and beyond the run of the mill sort of stuff. You know, we've been praising James Anderson, who had a sensational Test match in his own quieter way, but it wasn't as sensational as watching reverse swing at 90 plus miles an hour both directions and tearing out the cream of England's batting with barely a glimmer of resistance. I mean, it was unbelievably good. And he is unbelievably good. I mean, I think it was Cameron Ponsonby, actually. He did a piece about fast bowlers who just look quicker than they are. And Bumrah has this extraordinary ability because of his extraordinary action that his release point is almost in front of the popping crease. He releases it at high pace, about a meter in front of where you would expect the ball to be released. So he's bowling bloody quick anyway, but he's also bowling off 21 yards instead of 22. And he's reverse swinging it at high pace and high accuracy. I mean, the combination makes him incredibly hard to pick up, incredibly hard to line up. And you saw that, you know, Joe Root has clearly got major problems against him, got out to him 8 times now. Ben Stokes got out to him 13 times. You know, he's a guy who is headhunting the best in the world and doing it consistently. And yet, I maintain what I said at the top. This was one of the greatest contemporary piece of fast bowling I've seen, genuinely. You know, we see a lot of it. We, you know, there was some magnificent stuff down in Australia not so long ago, but you know, it is this was up there with as good as it gets. And yet England did find a way to fight back and give the impression that they could win this Test match despite that happening. I was just, when we were talking about the way in which England went about things, I was flicking through the last time they were in Vishakhapatnam, in fact, the 2016 tour. And I was just looking here, you know, you talk about this was an outstanding spell of fast bowling that ripped the game apart. But you look at what happened in that Test match, it was actually oddly similar in that India batted first, scored 455, a big century from Virat Kohli, another century from Pujara, who's obviously missing here. England responded with 255 compared to 253 on this occasion. And so, but on that occasion, he got 255 from 102.5 overs of hard graft from Joe Root, gets a 50, Ben Stokes gets 70, Johnny Bairstow gets a 50. So those three key players who are still in the team 8 years later are grafting away in the first innings, trying against all expectation to compete in India. They do their damnedest. They're batting at strike rates between 34 and 54, and they still concede a lead of exactly 200. So even when England were doing their damnedest to not get out in a very different mindset, they still got out in twice as many overs as this time, conceding a similar sort of lead. And then what happened in the second innings? They're chasing 405 compared to 399. And they go into a hole. I mean, Ben Duckett, in fact, was talking about it. He said that, you know, his instructions from Alistair Cook was don't get out. Just block for your life. Remember, that was a test which Cook and Hasib Hamid batted 50 overs for 75 runs. They bunkered down, trying not to get out. And then you look at the way that the five survivors from that test, you look at how they got out. Duckett comes in at number four, bats naught from 16 balls, and then tries a sweep and gets out because he's got close catches around him. Ben Stokes, six from 33 balls, and then gets a peach of a delivery from Giant Yadav and gets bowled. Then suddenly England, 115 for six, dead in the water. And look what happens. Johnny Bairstow starts teeing off, gets 34 out of from 40 balls as England bowled out for 158. The point is, England have tried surviving, tried not doing the wrong thing, tried to just hang in there previously, and they get stuffed every time. In this occasion, they were running towards the danger of Jasprit Bumrah bowling an outstanding spell, and they still end up getting the same amount of runs as they did in a bog-standard first innings when they were just batting for their lives and making sure they didn't make mistakes. So, you know, I can't fault the fact they're going about it this way, because it is already being proven to be a better, more effective way of mixing it with India than just hanging around waiting for the one that's going to have your name on it. Because if you're going nowhere against Jasprit Bumrah in that sort of form, you're talking about he's going to hit 6 for 10 rather than 6 for 45. You know, you're going to die in a ditch in a very, very different sort of way if you allow bowlers to bowl at you in India in this contemporary age.
Well, yes, and talking about the sort of those individual performances that lifted India, Bumrah, well, I'll say front and centre, there was quite a lot of argument about whether Jaiswal's double hundred should be a player of the match worthy, I think, as well. I think I'd have edged it towards Bumrah just because bowlers win you games. Vish, I mean, his record is quite incredible. 29 wickets now in six tests in India, so six home tests in a sort of five-year career, I think. But 29 wickets at 13.06. And he reached 150 wickets in this game. He's got the second-best average ever behind SF Barnes. And I, perhaps worst of all, your view might be different, but he's actually very likeable and smiling and, you know, he kills you with kindness in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you're that good, you don't really need to be mean, do you?
it's too much.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and understandably so. If you're that good at something, then just enjoy your life, because things are just going to come to you. I think what's really interesting is there was a lot of talk last year about Australia's pace attack and coping with them. And I think what helped England, actually, was you kind of prepare for one, you prepare for them all. So, you know, how you approach Cummins is not too dissimilar to how you approach Hazelwood. Not that they're, you know, two samey bowlers, more in the way that essentially your session is governed around pace, essentially. And I think what's interesting is you can almost tell that they've done so much work against spin because they've played it really well. I mean, there have been periods where Ravichandran Ashwin has been taken out of the attack because he's going at fives. You know, the ghost of Axar Patel seem to have been exercised pretty convincingly. In part because they probably, you know, they were too scared of him in 2021. And then it comes to, well, you know, you basically need Mark Wood and Gus Atkinson bowling thunderbolts at your batters so they can get used to it. Obviously, they've got dog throws as well, but even then, no one quite mimics Bumrah's action. So what do? You kind of get your dog thrower a little further on and you have that little stutter step. You almost kind of, your ideal net bowler will be a centaur with a doggy stick, wouldn't he? Because he'd do the little trot up and then he'd be able to fling it down. If you don't know what a centaur is, Google it.
I mean, I know you're in deepest darkest India, but are there any of those knocking round?
You know, I haven't actually gone out and checked all that much. So I imagine there's a chemical plant in the distance. Now, I reckon if we pushed, I don't know, Ali Martin of The Guardian and a horse in there with him, we might come out with a centaur like the fly.
I'm sure he would gladly sacrifice himself for that, for the cause.
Yeah, maybe. I'll ask him later. But, you know, and there's also the serious point of, like, maybe you just, how can you prepare against a bowler so unique? I think England have had moments against him. I don't know if you remember, because it you know, it was made entirely redundant. But just before that first burst of reverse swing from Bumrah in England's first innings, when he took three wickets for not very many, Zach Crawley hit him for four fours.
Yeah.
You know, one of them was an edge through the slips, but, you know,
that was at the back end of his opening spell, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't necessarily think they're scared of him, but they are scared of that second coming of Bumrah when the ball is reversing and he comes back on. You know, I had a look today and it's basically from, in terms of the wickets he's taken already, it's from 18 to about 45, which is a huge window, but it's essentially whenever the ball they're using at the time is reversing. And then you factor in the slower ball as well, which I thought England were picking, and then Ben Foulkes gets out to quite tamely in the fourth inning. So, you know, he's got all these tricks, and I do think they, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of respect for him, really. And I do think they're going to come back with some ideas of how to combat him a bit more. But ultimately, you know, you almost need the openers to have that impact on him early on and still be there when the reverse swing starts, because yeah, he's going to take wickets, but you just hope that you're not too exposed what he does.
On fast bowling greatness, Miller, you've mentioned James Anderson, but he's not quite as scary. He's not so polite and smiling either, but he was certainly back in the swing. I mean, after the Ashes that he had, and at age 41, the doubters aren't quick to reemerge. But 3 for 47, 2 for 29, 5 wickets away from 700 now. Only one visiting fast bowler in history has more than Anderson's 39 wickets in India now. And I'll give a bonus point to either of you who can get him. But yeah, I'll let you think about it. But it was, precision, immaculate. He's a dapper old gent, isn't he, Jimmy? And he showed it again in this test.
Very much so. I mean, you know, I remember we were talking about him in the start, before the start of the series. Can he come again? And, you know, I will concede. I thought the Ashes was a particularly worrying drop off. It was so unexplainable. I mean, he has gone out and said he's worked on a new run up, and so he clearly feels like there was something explainable. But it did look as though he'd just done what sometimes happens with aging athletes. They just wake up one morning and the snap had gone. There was that weird period in the final test of the Oval against Australia when it was self evident that there was no way England were going to turn to Anderson. Of all the people you would normally go to with a match on the wire, Anderson was nowhere to be seen. He was there giving support to Stuart Broad, who obviously did his heroics, but England could not trust him because he was not the bowler they needed at that moment. So, of course, you're going back out to India of all the places, you think, I mean, it's a fast bowler's graveyard by reputation. At the age of 41, nearly 42, is this wise? I mean, I dredged up an interview I did with him in 2008, in 2016, when I asked him that. Is it wise, Jimmy, recovering from a broken shoulder, to go out and play in India? And he bit my head off, saying, of course I want to go out and play. he just wants to be there. And he proved it with a sublime spell. It was so different to Bumrah, but it was so clever as well. I mean, that delivery that bowled Rohit Sharma in the second innings was just subtlety personified. I mean, you know, you don't often think of him like Glenn McGrath, essentially. But I remember McGrath, I think he must have been Bangalore in 2004, I remember him bowling Rahul Dravid with a ball that just did enough. McGrath, you know, McGrath's famously, you know, look at the way he got at Mike Atherton all the time. It was half a bat's width movement. That was all it took. It wasn't about an extravagant nip off the seam or anything. It was just half a bat's width, which takes from the middle of the bat to the edge of the bat. And this was something different entirely, because the previous ball had shaped in quite wickedly, and Rohit had played to protect his pads. And then suddenly he's beaten around the outside edge and still bowled off stump by a ball that, you know, even looking at it 100 times, I can barely see the movement. But it's all to do with the initial perception of that previous delivery. This is going to come back even further, and it holds its line essentially, and maybe moves half a millimetre the other way. It was unbelievably canny, and the sort of stuff you can only do if you know exactly where that ball is going to pitch. You can trust the fact that, you know, I know exactly within a sixpence of pitch where this is going to land, and I can calibrate accordingly. It was so clever, and the wobble seam across Jaiswal again, five balls later. And here's a guy who got 200 in the previous innings, and suddenly he's done in by another subtly different but very clever bit of bowling that was essentially completely different, swinging across the left-hander. But again, all comes down to that absolute relentless accuracy and command of seam position. So he's incredible. And this 10-day gap is perfect for him. You know, he had a big workload as a sole seamer as well. I mean, the other thing we haven't mentioned is that England are 1-1 and brawling in this series, despite not picking the right team yet. I mean, you know, arguably they've needed two seamers in both of their test matches. And the first test, arguably, the fact they had an extra spinner was good because Jack Leach was injured. But, you know, all things being equal, they had more spinners than they needed at any given point. Joe Root barely bowled in this test. Leach barely bowled in the last test. They have endlessly gone in with more spin than they need, and it's worked okay. But, you know, Ollie Robinson would have been a real handful on this pitch, I reckon, and they've got him up with the sleeve yet. So, you know, it's been witchcraft. And Stokes' captaincy, again, of the young spinners, another factor that we haven't really talked about yet. But, I mean, absolutely magical captaincy, just to dredge that level of belief at so many different moments when it looked like the game was slipping away from England. He would tinker with the field and coax another wicket just because he believed in the men at his disposal in a way that every other captain in history would have thought, my God, what have I picked here? Stick everyone on the boundary and let's just wait for them to declare.
Well, yeah, on that, Shoaib Bashir didn't take a five for Vish, you know, following on from Tom Hartley, Rehan Ahmed and Will Jacks under Stokes. But, that three-cap trio going into the game performed. I mean, they out-bowled, arguably, the home spinners. 15 wickets for 500 from 139 overs, compared to 9 for 363 from 80. So I think that's about 30-odd a wicket for England spinners and 40-something for India's. Obviously, we've talked about Jasprit Bumrah, but it was, like, pretty remarkable stuff. And then, you know, they've talked about what they'd seen in Shoaib Bashir, and we saw what Tom Hartley did in Hyderabad. But to hold it all together without Leach and without Root really bowling much as well, I mean, it was pretty special.
Yeah, it was you know, a huge plus point that they can take away from that defeat is just how those young spinners turned up. You know, I think it was maybe the first test where I got up the you know, the amount of overs that both Rehan and Tom Hartley have bowled in first-class games, whether it was, you know, in the entirety of the match or specifically in an innings. And I realise it's probably now redundant because they're just going to do more bowling over this tour than they've ever done, you know, from match to match. And it was, I don't know, it was really cool. I think cool is the right word, to see an England captain just leave a spinner on and, you know, rotate a bit from the other end, take them off when they're tired and, you know, put the others on, and all of them with a remit to attack. It's funny, this is a bit of a tangent here, but I think it's quite important. It was back in 2004, I think, maybe even a bit before that, certainly early 2000s, where the ECB employed Terry Jenner to come over and do basically work with England spinners. Now, Adil Rashid was one of the spinners that came through that, and you know, and a few others, including Will Beer, who was at Sussex. But they had this game penciled in for Loughborough, where it would be 11 spinners against 11 spinners. Basically, nothing but spin would be bowled, and people would bat, and they would play out the game like that. And they realised that it was stupid, that they couldn't go through with the game, or the game wouldn't work, is because they thought it would turn into a bit of a farce, because you can't leave a spinner on to bowl, you know, in the same kind of spells that you'd bowl a seamer, for example. And so they felt that they wouldn't be able to get the rhythm of the game right, that it wouldn't quite work, and it would be a bit of a foolish exercise. And now you're kind of fast forward however many years, and there's an England captain doing that in a test match. Now, it's a very unique England captain in Stokes, but and it's all the more ridiculous because it's essentially three kids. It does make you wonder about the ones that have fallen on the wayside. You know, I did a talk with a tour group yesterday with Marcus Truscothick, and Dom Best came up. You know, Dom Best took a five-wicket haul in the first Test match here in 2021. What we know of Don Best is that he started very early, too early, really, too early by, you know, certainly previous thinking, and struggled as soon as things didn't go well, and has basically fallen away. Because I suppose it wasn't a case of people not only didn't really have the same kind of tactical mind as Stokes, but there's also a duty of care there as well. And there was a real sense that when England picked these spinners, that God, you know, it's a hard place. Like, I get that this is a really comfortable environment, but like, how do you really, you know, how are you going to cope when things go badly? You know, it's not, you know, it's quite tetchy here, and you know, batters can go after them, might go for 5-6 and over, and how does a young spinner hold that, especially with so little experience to fall back on? But I don't know, they've all thrived, really, haven't they? It's been a huge success story, and perhaps a lesson that can filter through down to the rest of the game, because it's not so much about play like Baz ball in county cricket, this, that and the other, but I suppose it's a bit more like, look, just really, you can tell someone to back their spinner, but this is how you back your spinner. You know, you just treat them as a wicket taking threat.
Such a good point bringing up Best, though. And such a good point.
Accept that.
Yeah, such a good point bringing up Best, because he epitomises the lack of faith that England had on their last tour in 2021 compared to the absolute unbelievable, unrelenting faith they've got this time around. If you recall how he began his Test career, I think Best would be an outstanding Baz bowler. I genuinely think he's got the ticker for it, in the same way that Tom Hartley has got the ticker. He's just shown, from taking a 7-run debut and coming back from his first spell, to the way he's batted. Because Best, you know, got a 50 on debut when 21 or whatever. But if you recall the way that his career developed, he got I think in Port Elizabeth, he got the first 5 wickets to fall in the South Africa innings in a Test match victory. And then in Gaul, he got a 5-for. I mean, I think he got mocked for being an absolutely disgusting 5-for, full of long hops and all the rest of it. But it was 5 wickets, 8 in the match, in a victory in Gaul, as England won that series 2-0. Then he got 5-for in Chennai, as England won the Test match. He 5 across 2 innings. And then suddenly he goes for none in the Ahmedabad, and he gets thrown on the bus, and England say, well, he's mentally shot. He needs a break, and he hasn't been seen since. I mean, that, as you mentioned, the duty of care, I think that's absolutely shocking. You know, 8 wickets, 4 wickets, 5 wickets, his previous 3 Tests in Asia, and he gets a 0-for in a defeat in Ahmedabad, and he's drop-kicked out of the team and has never been seen since. You would not get that under Ben Stokes. He would be saying, well, he's my man. I have faith in this guy. He's done it for me already in 3 consecutive victories. I'm going to keep picking him, and I'm going to pump his tyres until he's back again. I hope he comes back again. If it does feel as though he's a long way away all of a sudden. But then that's the case with all spinners. I mean, sure, Bashir came from absolutely nowhere. He was playing minor counties cricket not so long ago, and now suddenly he's playing Test cricket. That is the fate of spinners in English cricket, is that you have to be plucked from nowhere, essentially, to get a chance because of the way the schedule is. But, you know, the faith and the belief that these guys can do it is something that is unheard of in English cricket and frankly, unparalleled.
Well, we're back to Stokes and his magic touch. Does he need to have a word with his senior spinner, Vish? Is this something that England needs to sort out over the next week? By which I'm referring to Joe Root, obviously. Not his bowling that's a concern, but 4 innings, the high score of 29. That second innings in Vizag, 16 off 10 balls, 2 reverse sweeps, a 6 over long off, and then a little miscued hoik to backward point. He obviously had hurt his finger in the field, and we don't really know how significant that is, perhaps, or how it was hampering him maybe while batting. But is there a danger he's sort of slipping back into this void where he's unsure of how to bat as a Baz bowler?
I mean, I think he is back in that void, as you put it. Oh, the void sounds quite tragic, doesn't it? I mean, he's in a funk. Let's call it a funk.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like a really dark space, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely in that funk, but I think it's just a product of being in new conditions. And it's, you know, I've written today, I think it's just a case of recalibrating to how he'd need to approach, to be more positive in, you know, playing on these pitches. Because... But then, you know, we're going to have the same conversation as we did when he was going through the initial funk. But, you know, Joe Root naturally goes at 4, 5, 6s and over without taking too many undue risks. He evidently thinks he needs to do a little bit more and sweep a bit more, which is fine. He's a very good sweeper. I think we can all agree on that. I think there's, you know, his little finger, as you mentioned, on his right hand was an issue. You know, it doesn't seem to be too big an issue. Like it certainly was an issue the night before, which is why he was off the field, but he batted and apparently it wasn't too much of a problem when he batted then. Apparently he was one of the people who woke up a bit crook with that virus. And so if, you know, I think the sentiment to those who did wake up and were a bit ill, go out there and get as, you know, and quick, you know, quick, as many quick runs as possible, which is not necessarily something you'd want to say to someone with that kind of ailment, but I think the message was received as intended. But yeah, there seems something that he's striving for. I mean, at the same time, you know, he got a good ball. He's got a couple of good balls from Bumrah. You know, the second dismissal at the end of the first test, and then the first dismissal here in Vizag. But you know, he's capable of doing more. I think we're gonna see that. Brendan McCullum in his conversation with us that's due out today said that he fully expects to Root to score, and I quote, a shit ton of runs for the rest of the series. So, I mean, he's not going to say anything else, is he? But I don't necessarily think they're all worried about that. But certainly, you know, to look at his body language, Joe definitely is. And I don't think he bowled that well in the second test, actually. I think, you know, he obviously went down in that third innings, but he was hooked pretty early in that first innings, which led to Bashir being brought on as early as he was, even though they did wait a bit in both innings for Rehan as well. So, yeah, I think he's in a bit of an odd place, and you know, he's always been a home badger, if that's the phrase. But you know, so maybe seeing his family and his kids again will just remind him that, you know, it is only just a game. And yeah, Rajkot could be the start of a good purple runner form for him.
Yeah, well, he's a home badger who scored more runs in India, I think, than any other overseas batter. So and got 100 in Rajkot last time round, I think. Miller looking on ahead to that third test. We're a bit far out to think about what the pitch will be like and who England might bring in and so on. I mean, I guess the hope will be that Jack Leach is fit to at least put his hand up for selection. You touched on whether they should be playing a second seamer. India have been playing two seamers, although I don't think they've really needed the second seamer either, but that's a different equation for them to solve. I mean, there have only been two tests played at Rajkot, one of them by England, Haseeb Hameed's debut in 2016, and one in 2018. So there are quite a lot of unknowns, quite apart from the fact England are going to Abu Dhabi to play golf for the week in between.
Yeah, aren't they just? I mean, you know, in terms of selection, you know, the Bazball way has been very much to stick to the same team. It's like, you know, you don't make a change if you feel like the team is doing most things right, which I think it is. What is there to change? I think that there is a case, as I mentioned earlier, for an extra seamer. So I'd probably say thanks, Shoa, you can come again, but bring in Ollie Robinson. That would be my change. I don't think I'd make any other changes, to be perfectly honest. I think Tom Hartley has shown ample ticker, and his batting prowess is up there with Leach's stickability and more, to be honest. His launching of sixes off Ashwin is something that has been a real feature of England's fight in both second innings. So I wouldn't change that, and I wouldn't change the batting either. I think, you know, who knows if Harry Brook gets back in or comes back after his personal issues. But You know, Johnny Bairstow, I think, has played incredibly well. He's looked bristling and brawling and up for the fight, but hasn't reached 40 yet in four innings. But I wouldn't change that. I think he looks in the mood. And he had a run-in with Ashwin after he got out, which I always think is a good sign for Bairstow. If he feels like he's got a fight to pick, he will go and pick it and win it, because that's kind of how he operates. So I would trust Bairstow to come out brawling in Rajkot. And just finally on Root, I mean, you know, it's clear that something isn't quite right with the way he's going about things. But again, if you look at the overall record of Bazball, he averages 52 at a strike rate of 75 under Bazball. It's he averages 49 overall, strike rate near a 50 overall. So, you know, he's going quicker and scoring more runs per innings in this era than he was previously. Admittedly, you know, the peaks and troughs are fairly frequent, and we've seen, you know, two winters running now. He's gone a bit missing overseas, but then he came back and got a big 100 in New Zealand last year. And 100 in the Ashes Test, opening Ashes Test. You know, he's got the class to come again. But, you know, our friend George De Bell was writing about England, making poker analogies about England, saying he wishes they folded more often and stopped going all in all the time. I didn't think his analogy was quite spot on, but I think there's more of an analogy with Root, is that he's a bit on these what poker players would call on tilt at the moment. He's had a few bad losses, particularly I think the World Cup. I think of all the players who came out of that World Cup, Root was probably the one who came out with the most questions about his own game, because he was just so below the standards that he expects of himself. And it looks as though he's rushing to try and make up his losses, which is basically what happens when you're on tilt. You've had a bad beat. You're thinking, am I going to try and win my money back quickly, play the wrong shot, overplay your hand, get out quickly, and you're even deeper in the red. That feels like what he's doing at the moment. He's to take a breath, maybe a 10 days in Abu Dhabi, breathe more deeply, and stop rushing his innings. And as Vish mentioned, he bats at four fives anyway when he's in on songs, so he doesn't need to play Bazball. And that, I suppose, is the other fundamental thing, that this mentality has improved every single player in that team, particularly the young players who were directionless, except for Root, who, you know, incremental improvements in strike rates and marginal average. But overall, it hasn't benefited his game, because if you remember what happened pre to Bazball, Joe Root was carrying the team and everyone else was clinging onto his coattails. So he was the one guy in that side who did not need to change the way he was going about things, whereas absolutely everything else about his team needed to be ripped up. And so if all of a sudden he is unsure of what his game is, it's hardly surprising, because his game was working absolutely perfectly even while England were winning one in one match in 17 previously. So, you know, if he's feeling a little bit discombobulated, not sure of his role, which has been a theme all the way through, and I reiterate, his record is better under this regime than previously, but it doesn't look better because everyone else has improved so much more around him and he's just stayed pretty damn good. And so, you know, we'll see. I would suspect he won't be in this rut for long.
A shit ton of runs coming. You heard it here first. Just one last thing, Vish. Is there any sense that Harry Brook might be back in the mix at some point? If not after this break, then later in the tour?
No. There's been no update on that, in part because England have basically not even tried to contact Harry Brook because of the nature of the personal matter that he returned home to deal with. So it would just be a case of them hearing from him, and I suppose they haven't heard from him yet. Yeah.
Well, we will wait to hear and hope all is well with him. There hasn't been too much else from an England perspective beyond the Test tour. The under-19s finished fourth in Group 2 of the Super 6 at the World Cup. The most headlines, I think, created by Hamza Sheikh being given out obstructing field. I don't know if either of you have strong opinions on that, but
stop picking up the bloody ball.
That would solve it. Courtney Walsh, by the way, was the answer to the visiting fast bowler who has more wickets in England, in India, than James Anson, so another old stager with plenty of miles in the legs, although he has retired, unlike James Anderson. And I think that will do us for today. England get their heads down for a week in the nets before Rajkot. Only kidding, they've of course gone off to play golf in another country. We'll be sticking around though. We're not going anywhere. We'll be back to preview the third test next week. Until then, my thanks to Miller and Bish, and to you all for tuning in to the Switch It podcast on ESPNCricketInfo.com.